Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Joel Harrison, and sitting beside me, as usual, Dave Taylor, who just told me a couple of minutes ago, basically, I'm an old man who doesn't understand meme culture.
Yeah, I was just sharing some shout out to the people in the eschatological posting group. Y'all need Jesus. Joel doesn't understand.
I don't understand memes. Anything. Yeah. I don't understand how computers work. I don't get anything. But that's why then Dave had to actually direct me to the fact that we have reviews on our podcast.
Yes.
And show me that they're there, which is amazing. So I got to read them. One person says, best pro-Brexit podcast around. Love the metaphor of re-enchantment as a way of describing British independence. So that's good.
Yeah.
That's helpful. That will get us up the ranks. Maybe one day we'll surpass Joel Osteen. That's our goal, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's fascinating seeing what the other recommended podcasts, if you click on ours.
Joel
Osteen will be one
Is
of
he?
Them. And yeah.
Really?
Yep. Yeah. And
that's atrocious. What have we done to be how did that happen?
Well, your name's Joel.
Liam must look into this. He understands algorithms.
Yeah. I've got a winning smile.
Oh, okay.
I think they're the similarities.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There you go. Reenchanting Anglicanism from M. Kulsb.
I think that's pretty Mads.
Thank you, M. Kulsb. This is really nice, actually. Perfect blend of critical analysis and mysticism. It's also hilarious. Highly recommend. Exclamation.
Oh.
Wow. We got the exclamation at the end. I'm feeling quite nice about it. Thank you. Thank you, McCausb. It's Maddie, isn't it? Yeah. The wandering thoughts you'd love, and then it cuts off.
Can you not use phones because you're an old man?
I'll try to click on something. I don't know how this works. Joel and Dave, obviously fast friends and bros. Oh, this almost sounds like a New Zealander giving us a review. That's nice. Wonderful conversations, hilarious chat. This is very nice. Thank you, everyone, for these reviews. Please keep giving us more of them, preferably not about Brexit.
Or being a men's rights activist.
David, we follow the consumers. We go where the people want us to go. So this episode, we're discussing liturgy and the liturgical crimes.
Speaking of men's rights activists.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, there's no real segue here. So we're discussing liturgy and liturgical crimes. Liturgy, otherwise, if we understand that as the work of the people in its original Greek sense. Two parts we're interested in here. The first, we're going to be discussing why it is that David and I became attracted to liturgy, why we think it's important in the life of the church. And then secondly, we're going to get on to what we're maybe calling liturgical crimes, given the importance of liturgy and what it may mean, how we then die a slow death when we are in a church that purposefully mangles liturgy. So this episode raises why liturgy is important. Now, some of our listeners obviously come from a range of backgrounds and may not actually even be familiar with liturgical frames and so on. That's fine. We're just raising it as a matter of, well, here's something to think about. And also as a matter of Christian political and ethical formation, I think. And then mainly we're probably going to be discussing this about how mangling liturgy makes us want to cry in the shower. So it's a why church why episode for us also. So Dave, I'll ask you first, why have you found liturgy attractive, or what do you think is the importance of it? Hold on, let me just give, before I go there, a bit of a sort of what do we mean when we say liturgy, right? So it's original Greek refers to the work of the people, and we're talking about the words, the rhythms, the songs, the forms, and the movement towards and the sending out from the sacrament that entails the shaping of the people gathered together in worship, right? And this takes particular forms, and we being Anglicans, that often is formed out of prayer books. which means we don't just simply have, as in our context, a statement of beliefs, but we have a posture of worship, right? A posture that unites us in that way. It's something distinctive. So Sam Wells, in his book about Anglicanism, talks about not having necessarily the one authoritative leader, but or a declaration of faith. Now you could contest these points, but rather there's a pattern of prayer is actually has been historically in ways seen as fundamental. So, Dave, now that doesn't mean now what we're not going to, I should also say what we're not going to do in this episode is debate the different forms, right? So if you want to have a really fun time, go up to a traditionalist Catholic and say, I think Vatican II was an amazing step for liturgical worship and see what happens. So we're not going to be debating that. We're just doing more of a what about liturgy in general and then into...
So as, you probably get a good sense of my background as far as my faith goes from the brittle fundamentalism episode we did. But, I come out of a kind of low church background. And in answering the question of why liturgy for me, part of it is this kind of constant struggle within myself to feel Christian, to feel like my faith was kind of authentic. And actually part of embracing liturgy, by which I mean set structures in worship, set prayers, set readings and things like that, was actually part of giving over this idea that it was up to me to generate what it means to be a Christian, and instead to kind of enter into a set form that would shape what it means for me to be a Christian, that would lend words to what it means to be a Christian, that would literally kind of shape the architecture of my spiritual life. And that's kind of coming out of being a person who is quite, I don't know, melancholic, quiet, kind of chaotic in my inner life at times. Having something that is fixed and set that's not dependent on my consistency, my emotional consistency, my strength of resolve or something like that, but is instead there no matter what I'm feeling. I found that incredibly liberating.
So I was the same. And this is actually one of the fundamental reasons why I jumped the Thames. Because I, in that Pentecostal context, that's what I would describe as a continual bombardment of being, you know, like a clanging gong going at you saying, do you really love God? Do you really? Constantly words thrown at you. And that sense that I had to manifest that in the continual assertion of an authentic expression.
Yeah.
And that need for that self-expressing was just exhausting.
Yeah. And for me, it was a real, I suppose, this might sound self-aggrandizing a bit and might not reflect what was actually going on. But for me, there was this continual intellectual push, these questions that kept on coming up, so much so that I'd always feel like my faith was contingent on me coming to resolve a question that had occurred to me. But by learning that, I could just go to church and the church would be there and I could leave the questions at the door and just go in through those practices, that became a safe and secure foundation on which to then go and explore questions or come to peace with those questions. And it was actually through understanding how, and I suppose I'll get onto this a bit later maybe, actually it was the postures of kneeling it later, most recently, learning to kneel, learning to cross myself, learning, going to a church where you kneel at communion. Though that completely, in some strange way, reoriented my thinking.
So let's take this, because I think that's important. Yeah. So let's put embodiment to one side and come back to it. But your point there about that you could just come to the church. Now, I think there's something crucial there as well about that.
Like I didn't need to have it sorted out.
You didn't need to have it sorted out, but also you didn't need to make it up.
Yes.
Right? Making it up was exhausting.
Yes.
Now, I grew up in a context where if you didn't extemporize your own prayers, you were being inauthentic and something was wrong with you. And that's exhausting.
Yeah.
Right. But actually to then have a trust.
Yeah.
In which something is given. And you know, this is something that Liturgy in Ways teaches, is that there's a givenness to what you are going to now speak and go through as motions. Mm. And then that reflects the givenness of life as such, yeah. right? You're not just this total self-author making up what it means to express your Christian yeah. faith at a given time. So there's something there about trusting yeah. that people have gone before me. They have gone through these motions. They have thought about it before.
Yeah.
And I can in some ways rest in that, yeah. right? That it's not entirely on my shoulders.
Yeah. And then on a related point, going into a kind of type of social critique, if you like, learning to embrace the ordinary, learning to embrace the rhythms of liturgical life, embrace the sameness week in and week out of a liturgy, it became a real resistance for me to capitalism's insistence on perpetual novelty, that we live in a society that is built on discontent, that is built on the continual pursuing of the new, because we couldn't function if people were content, because we require people buying new crap. And I think that is related to, I think, my epistemological crisis of constantly having these questions, because I'm formed in a culture that doesn't lend itself to certitude and contentment with one's kind of faith.
Okay, so I think that's right, the ordinariness, but I think you'd have to complicate it a little, because I actually think as well what liturgy does is it keeps returning you back to ordinary things. So bread and wine is, in a sense, is in a sense ordinary. The words that we speak together, they're sort of, you know, they're done in a repetitive manner, so week in, week out.
Mm.
But also liturgy is about the heights of drama, I think. So you move through.
But it's cyclical.
Yeah, but you move through, like if you take just a liturgical service, you move from, you know, the gathering, the procession, which reflects the exilic people processing towards God. Then you move into absolution. So you're entering into God's presence. Then you move towards songs of praise, scriptures, narrating us into the story, the sermon, which is a reflection on that, the prayers of the people, and then into affirmation, and then up to the heights of Eucharistic celebration, right?
Mm.
And so there is not just, it's not just repetition in the kind of like, well, this is just ordinary,
yeah.
which it is, but actually I found also that it's true drama, like yeah. it's not the confected drama of I'm a spectator, right? So this is what I find so ironic about people, you know, when they claim against liturgy, oh, it's so priestly, it's so hierarchical, something like this, right? When actually I think, no, it's not, because it's the people themselves who are doing the work.
Mm.
And that's in contrast to, say, I'm having to sit there and actually be a spectator in relation to somebody up the front jamming on a guitar
yeah.
and extemporizing prayers between various songs, you yeah. know, asking me, do I really yeah. feel, do I feel the mood sort
yeah.
of stuff?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think there's, but there's, so it's about the true drama that takes place. And then that's also reflected in more liturgical context. You have also seasons
yep.
and lectionary. And you work your way through old and new, and you have then the very heights of like the Paschal
yeah.
Triduum over Easter, right?
Yeah.
In which you go from Maundy Thursday, the depths of despair, into Good Friday and total desolation, and then into, you know, Easter Sunday, resurrection, and so on. And these sorts of things are mapped out liturgically.
Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, within the low church settings I grew up in, anything's up for grabs any yeah. given Sunday.
Yeah.
It depends upon what the minister yeah. decides is going to be the theme for that given week.
Yeah, and part of those dramatic rhythms that you enter into, what that ends up doing is it is meant to and it's built to disciple you over a lifetime, so that those rhythms get internalized and shape your inner life. They provide the language that you use, and you find this in the English literary tradition. That the Book of Common Prayer shapes English literature, because it is just the language people speak. And this equips people into old age. And so by the time, and this is what church is meant to be doing, preparing people for the moment of their death, by the time you get to that, hopefully at an old age, you've had a lifetime of exposure to liturgical structures and readings that have left a pattern on your mind.
Well,
and
not just your mind.
And your passions.
Because it's your body as well, as you were saying. So James K. Smith, who I may offer a slight criticism to later, but says before we articulate a worldview, we worship, right? And the idea there is you embody this. And so in his writing, he talks about it as creating an affectiveness, as in it generates desire in you because you imprint it upon your body through habits, or it cultivates what Charles Taylor calls an understanding, which is like the social background. So you cross yourself, as you said, you kneel, you participate in through your whole body, so it becomes your body is involved in a posture of worship.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's not just a case of, well, behind that is some propositional content and that's the real thing.
So there's a, so getting back to this idea that you're being shaped towards your death, shaped to embrace your mortality and the reality of aging, for example. Whereas in these kind of, one of my frustrations with my low church context is that they designed their churches and their services for teenagers or people with young children. And that's the ideal Christian. You're either a teenager or someone that's just had children. And that is completely reflective of our consumerist culture because they are the people that buy shit. Like they are the people that buy consumer goods. Fashion, entertainment is shaped towards adolescence. Or the other time where you're consuming the most is when you're buying things, when you're buying things for children and things like that. And so we end up just reinforcing and replaying the kind of culture of consumerism.
Right. So there's two things, if I can.
But basically, we're a society of perpetual adolescence,
right?
And that this deliturgical deliturgizing church is actually, I think, reflective of this.
See, I think you could add as another category to that there's disenchanted boomers.
Yeah. Right.
So. Often you hear someone say, they say, well, some people don't go in for liturgy because they find it not missional and so on. Mm. The boomer who walks in and goes, oh no, this reminds me of when I was forced to go to chapel, right? But that seems to be the only person I can think of, right? Because I tend to think if you're walking into a church, you're probably looking for something that's slightly jarring, transcended, different, that breaks you out of the very modes of thinking that you're dealing with. And the modes of thinking, when you're talking about just being a consumer, and I said, as well, you become like a spectator.
Yes.
Which is contrary to what the liturgy is supposed to be doing, is forming you as a people. So it's that the work of the people. So all those movements and rhythms are talked about, you're doing it together. Now, some people say that, it's just for these, it's almost like an intellectual caste who likes this sort of stuff. And yet I actually thought, well, in ways it's deeply egalitarian.
Yes.
Because you repeat it each week. You do the same thing. You're all in there together doing the exact same thing. It's not dependent on your own individual agency, but it's all of you working through it together. So there's something there about the political formation of a body of people, right, who are processing towards a goal together, who are processing towards God together.
Yeah. And it's also, I hate to even go down a pragmatic route, but I think there is a deep desire for people in our day and age to tap into a historical narrative, to actually find themselves in something that's in continuity with some sort of tradition because of stuff that we've talked about numerous times on different episodes, the flattening out of space, the flattening out of time. People are longing to find some sort of alternative to the way in which we're putting together our common life. And rather than just replicating the nature of our socioeconomic order, we should be providing that alternative. And I know countless people who are religious or are non-religious or on their way to thinking about through religion that are longing for these kinds of spaces, these beautiful spaces, these peaceful spaces, this beautiful language, things like that.
Okay, so this raises the question, if we think this is actually important, then when do we end up crying in the shower, Dave?
So I think the one consistent bugbear that I have of many is just filling every second with noise. There has to be a word of explanation at every point. There has to be a word that sermons become half an hour diatribes of, again, explanation. And otherwise, it's music. There's no time for silence and stillness. And my fear is that all of this desire for noise and filling up space with noise, it ends up communicating a deep anxiety on the part of the believer, an anxiety that we have God's approval, an anxiety that we are saying the right thing, not that saying the right thing isn't important, but rather than a confident stillness in or awe in the face of the divine.
So I think that's absolutely right. The bombardment of words is a big problem, and I think it comes in two forms. So you have explanatory content, right? The person who stands up and says, and now we're about to do this and let me explain it all to you. And then you also have another version of it, which you find in some churches where you have text that somebody doesn't quite like. Mm. They find a little too hard-edged. And so they stand up and they explain to you how this is quite a challenging text and maybe it's not something we'd agree with in our present context and all that sort of thing. So it's almost like...
Or they do their best to say that they don't really mean what they're saying.
I don't really mean this. We don't really mean this. You know, sort of that progressive version of it, right? Yeah. But in both cases, behind that, I think, is an idea that the explanation is more important or more privileged than the thing itself.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Whereas what the Christian formation entails is the movement of the thing itself towards engaging in these forms, towards, you know, sacrament.
Yeah.
Right.
Or if you do sacraments, that you spend most of the time explaining that it's not really that important.
Yeah, right. So there's that problem in that it has an idea that we're privileging propositional content as opposed to the ethical formation of the work of the people. Mm. And then secondly, at a very practical level, it interrupts the flow.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I think liturgy is incredibly important in one sense, and in a very important way, because it protects you against the minister.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. It protects you against them because you don't want to be captured by a minister's neuroses or predilections or fads or whatever.
Have we talked about this on the podcast before, about this strange dynamic where
the low churches are the most clerical. Yeah. Low church paradox in which they are the most clerical because they get to determine the entire orientation of the entire service is based on their choosing of the themes and so on.
And it becomes much more about the preacher's
explanation,
personality.
It becomes much more about explanation and then the preacher's personality and so on. So it injects their authority as an imprint upon the work of the people as they're doing it. You know, we've been in contexts where the prayers of the people are about to be done and the minister stands up to do it. You know, this is just amazing stuff, right? So that's I think, incredibly important that you don't want to actually be caught in, you know, a single person's desire to say, make it fresh or engage in syntactical innovations, right? Because what, and here's, but here's another thing I hate about that, right?
Yeah.
Because when they do engage in their own little innovations, when I'm faced with the liturgy as it has been set down for some time, right, and I know it, and then we affirm it, say the creed, we affirm it together. And I go, yes, we affirm this as the church. But then if you add in new stuff in a given week, right, you just throw in your own thing. You take out the creed, and as I was in one service once, they added in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, right? Just the problems of translation there are amazing. But, you know, what it does is it takes you out because you have to do two things. You're first of all gritting your teeth going, why are we doing this? But you have to suddenly go, we're supposed to be affirming this as a church. So as I'm reading this new thing, I'm trying to decide as now an individual whether I think we as the church should affirm this.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
I'm taken out of worship.
That's right.
And I'm put into their explanatory head.
And the same,
I don't want to be.
But I think there's the same problem for myself, and I think this might be the case for a lot of modern people around silence generally, in that I need a lot of time to clear my mind.
Right.
I need a lot of time to be able to sit and center myself, actually kind of rethink about what I'm doing here before I can keep going. And I find in most churches, there's no space to actually do that. I know ideally I'd turn up half an hour early and pray and things like that before the service. But I just find contemporary worship just too noisy to do this.
Well, there's that. And then you're right, because you need silence as part of the movement. Yes. So you receive the Eucharist and you go back to your pew, you kneel in silence, right? Yeah. Unless you're honest with our 2-year-old, in which case you're out the back running around.
There's this beautiful in Screwtape Letters. I was going to read another passage from Screwtape Letters about that human beings being embodied and what they do with their body affects their soul. I won't do that now, but there's this beautiful picture where the devils are talking in Screwtape Letters about heaven as a place where all that is not music is silence. Whereas the devils live in the kingdom of noise. And I often think about that when I'm in a particularly elevating service.
Well, it's Huxleyan as well.
Yeah, right.
Right? You know, Huxley has the idea that it's not Orwellian in that we're under the eye of Big Brother, but actually Huxley is more, we're just inundated with crap.
Yeah, that's right.
No one can think. This is actually, I think, one of the bigger problems in our society is that no one's thoughts can be elevated because there's no time to do so, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So I think your one about the clanging gongs of a contemporary worship, that's one. Mm. But the other version of that is in a low church evangelicalism where it's dressed up as liturgy, but what it really is just a series of sermons strung together, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So you'll have a guest preacher will give a sermon, and then the minister will go, oh, well, looks like we've got a bit of a sermon off.
Yeah. Or you'll go to, no. never mind. Can I read you a passage from Rowan? So I've just been reading
Papa Rowan,
brilliant book, Being Human by Rowan Williams. Great little 100-page book that you can read in a day. But this is a passage about just what we're talking about from the end of it, from a chapter called Silence and Human Maturity. And Rowan Williams says this: making space, acting, moving, speaking in a way that makes space around it. That's what liturgy needs to be. I think that is why people so often appreciate so deeply the liturgies of monastic communities, where space around the words happen quite naturally. People have the sense that the words are coming out of a steady, patient attentiveness, and they're going back into it. To listen to a monastic choir singing compline is to listen to the opposite of busyness and to witness the opposite of fuss. We can't all be monastic choirs singing compline. Not every parish can do that. And yet it seems to me a good question to be asking in the routine life of worship and liturgy in the church. Is our worship, are our words the kind of thing that suggests moving out of and into that silence?
Absolutely.
Amen.
Yeah, I mean, it puts me in mind of going to an evensong.
Yeah.
And which it is aesthetically darkened into candlelight.
Mm.
And you are not active all the time. It's not reliant on you. You do participate, but you're also part of being swept up into something, right? So there is silence and there is movement and there are songs, but it's not just you. You have moments of just, you know, your own reflection and prayer. I think, you know, this sounds like, it can be bagging out ministers, but like, it also means that there's a very important role, right, which is about stewarding that language.
Mm.
Because what we're also saying then is that there's silence, but then the words spoken really do matter.
Mm.
Because if we're talking about the words in their own kind of reaching out way mediate
that's right.
that life of the people, then what we say in that context matters also. And I find this, or what we do as well, and this is just my last thing I wanted to raise, was I do get a little, you know, critical pang in my brain when I read someone like James K. Smith, who talks about liturgies a lot, and he defines liturgies as rituals of ultimate concern, and he's right in a sense. He then goes into talking about the cathedral, the shopping mall as kind of a liturgical practice because it's the forming of the people as into an identity as a consumer, right, through collective rhythms of worship. And that makes sense.
Kavanaugh would say the same thing as well.
Yeah, totally. And that makes sense. But then what happens is that then people start saying something like, Everything's liturgy.
We don't need communion. We'll just have dinner together.
That's right. Yeah. And they say things like, so in James K. Smith's book on Thinking in Tongues, he'll say, Pentecostals have liturgies. It's just the altar call. To which I go, no, what we need to then say is, what's good liturgy?
Yeah.
So there's a reason why the altar call is not a great liturgy, because if that's the end and high point of the service, only some people receive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. As opposed to Eucharistic celebration. Yep. So there, that would be my argument.
And that attentiveness and precision around the words that are being used as well, because they're not your words and you don't get to, you don't get to decide what they are.
Yeah.
They're words that have been thought about by the saints over centuries. I find that deeply, it reminds me of a line that Howard was always saying, like, how should we pray? The way porcupines screw with great care. that sense that actually the words that we use matter. And this is, again, going back to our previous episodes, this is how the church has to be an antidote to bullshit. Mm. So that we actually care about the words that we use, and they're not up to us. Anyway. How do you feel like you got in things off your chest?
I just have your Look, I feel better now. I mean, I started off this episode in which I had just re-looked at the fact that you had ranked all the MCU movies in the MCU universe and got it so abysmally wrong, to the point that 44 comments were made on your status saying how wrong you were. So now I feel much more relieved.
Silence speaks volumes. It's the comments that aren't being made that I care about. If you do want to go to a good church, I've been loving going to
St. Anne's Churchfield. Oh, fine. It's
10 a.m. So it's beautiful liturgical service.
Go for it.
Lovely multicultural setting. Mm. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Please like us on social media and just generally.
When you see us on the street.
Yeah. Just look at us and give us like a wink and a nod.
Yeah.
Except for Joel when he's at campus because it affects his gravitas. Please like us on Facebook by just searching us for the Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter at UCAT, EUCAT _ podcast. Please write us a review on whatever platform you listen to us and share us around. That really helps us build up our audience. Please don't leave a review if you're really angry at us for making fun of your whole way of being a Christian. We'll be taking next week off as we research and record, and then we'll see you the week after. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you then.